days. Otherwise, it'll take longer. My plan is to start with a very short, like a 10-minute version, or maybe 8-minute version of my witness testimony conversion story, and then maybe about an equal length discussion, a little bit of the role of Judaism in salvation history, because that's what I wrote a book about, and that's part of why I'm doing this. And the two are very connected. At this time, take a question, please. So anyway, I grew up Jewish. My parents are Holocaust refugees. They both grew up in Germany and left when Hitler came to power. My father got out relatively straightforwardly. There was a short period when Hitler was actually urging the Jews to leave as long as they left behind all of their possessions. And he left then. My mother fled to France and got caught up in the Nazi occupation of France and actually escaped. She was on a train going to the concentration camp. She was taken off by the Gestapo for questioning because they thought she knew something. And she didn't, and then she was being held until the next train to the concentration camp and escaped the night before the train left for the concentration camp. They met in this country. They married. I was raised relatively religious Jewish in a suburb of New York City. I had one, Hebrew school and Jewish worship was the center of my life, really. And I went to the summer between high school and college. I actually even lived and traveled with a Hasidic rabbi, the Hasids you saw today, right? Those are the long ear curls. In Israel, and thought of joining a yeshiva. You saw the yeshivas too. You may not have known what they were, but along the side of the Wailing Wall, there were like buildings, and they had doorways, big entryways, and they had like signs on top of them. And those were different yeshivas. And I actually thought of staying in Israel and doing that, which is essentially the Jewish version of religious life. But I didn't. I went back and went to MIT. I lost my faith at MIT, I think largely because some of it was the mindset, but some of it was also probably the lifestyle, which I enthusiastically embraced. This was the late 60s and early 70s. And then I went on to Harvard Business School, got an MBA there, was invited to join the faculty. And so I was teaching marketing at Harvard Business School at the age of 29, which is kind of where I'm going to start my story, because what was going on was all my life, I did have a very religious nature, and I always felt that, someday I will come into knowledge of the real meaning of life. And as long as I had these external goals, first of all, as a kid, I thought it would happen. First, I thought it would happen when I got bar mitzvah. I thought it would happen when I grew up. I thought it would happen when I was on my own and so forth. And then that seeking the meaning of life is kind of temporarily a substitute for by having external goals, you know, like getting into MIT or getting into Harvard Business School or, you know, starting my career. And none of those external goals, meant anything as far as the meaning of life. And so here I was on the faculty of Harvard Business School. I didn't have any more external goals, and life still had no meaning or purpose. And so I was actually in a state of tremendous despair. And I was walking in nature one day, kind of in my gloomy thoughts, and I received the single greatest grace of my life. I was just walking along alone, and I found myself in the presence of God, seeing my life as though I were looking at my life after death in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything, everything I would be happy about and everything I would wish I had done differently. I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be all of the time and energy I wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I imagined could exist coming from the hands of this all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that everything we did had a moral content that mattered for all eternity, that we had the ability, basically, every minute to do something for which we would be grateful for all eternity. You know, we would be essentially reaping the benefits in eternity for all eternity. And I'll say, I was entirely Jewish, right? I had no sense of Catholic theological perspective. So basically what I'm saying is I was not only entirely selfish and egotistical, I didn't even realize that was a fault. I thought that was the way you were supposed to be. So I actually realized in an instant that if I was smart about being selfish, I would try to be as much like Mother Teresa as possible. Because that's where true self-interest lies, is to be as great a saint as possible. And I had this basically selfish attitude towards it, but still, that's what I realized I should do. And I prayed to know the name. Another thing I saw in this experience was that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from the hand of an all-knowing, all-loving God, especially those things which seemed like the greatest disasters at the time. And I prayed to know his names. I knew from one moment to the next that the meaning and purpose of my life is to worship and serve him. And so I prayed, let me know your name. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. So he didn't reveal his name to me. I went back home to Cambridge, where I was living, to my life of teaching and consulting, happy in some sense for the first time since childhood, because I knew that not only was there meaning to life, but it was far greater and far more significant than I had ever dared hope for. And I knew that I wanted to pursue this experience and this God. So every night before going to sleep, I said a short prayer to know the name of my Lord and Master who had revealed himself on the beach. And a year to the day after the initial experience, I went to sleep, and I felt as though I was woken by a hand on my shoulder, and led to a room, and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could imagine, just to be in the presence of the purity and intensity of love coming from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist. And I knew without being told it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. My immediate impulse was I just wanted to throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her. As a matter of fact, one of my first thoughts was, oh my goodness, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. But I didn't. She said she would answer any questions that I had for her. So in fact, the first question I asked her, because I wanted to honor her and didn't even know the Hail Mary, was, what's your favorite prayer to you? Her initial answer was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little pushy. And I won't attribute that to any particular ethnic background. Although since there's been,
part of the country.
Since there have been four of us on this trip, you may have noticed it anyway. So I said, well, you must love some more than others. And she relented, and she recited a prayer in Portuguese. I didn't know any Portuguese. So the best I could do was make the effort to phonetically remember the sound of it. And as soon as I woke up, I wrote down phonetically the sound. And later when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all the Marian prayers in Portuguese so that I could identify. And as far as I could tell, it was the Portuguese version of O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us, have recourse to thee. And when I said this to this Portuguese woman, she got all excited. She said she was from the Azores, and where she came from, that was the first prayer mothers taught their infant children as soon as they were able to speak. So I figured that might be a reason why it was a favorite prayer for us, too. Anyway, I asked about four or five other questions. She answered them. And then she spoke to me for a while. And then the audience was over, and I went back to sleep. I know that technically I was asleep at the time, but it didn't feel like it. I mean, the experience feels like I was awake. The feeling of thinking through the questions feels like I was awake and so forth. My memory is sharp as though I were awake. Anyway, so the next morning when I woke up, I knew it had been Christ on the beach. And I knew I wanted nothing more than to be as fully and completely a Christian as I possibly could. I still didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what a Protestant was or what a Catholic was. And so I didn't really have much I could do other than open a phone book and find a church. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's basically true. And I started going to a Protestant church, but as soon as I got to know the pastor, I asked him, you know, well, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And when he answered dismissively, not treating her with the respect that I know was her due, and as a matter of fact, I knew what her stature was as the so much the ultimate creature that, tell the truth, during this experience, one of the mistakes I made was that I actually started to worship her. As a matter of fact, I'll tell another one of the questions and answers, which was one of my questions to her, because I was so overwhelmed by her glory was, how can this be? You're so magnificent, you're so glorious, you're so exalted. And she just looked at me kind of pityingly and shook her head and said, oh no, you don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a created thing. I'm a creature. He's everything. But so, anyway, so I basically, what led me to the Catholic Church was I knew who Mary was, and I had a love for Mary, which I hope never goes away. And so I was spending all my free time hanging out at Marian shrines, which are all Catholic, and often finding myself at Masses. And whenever I found myself at a Mass, I really wanted to receive communion. And so it was basically wanting to receive communion and knowing who Mary was, which led to the Catholic Church. And so that's that. I've already gone over the 10 minutes, so that's basically the very short version of my conversion story. I don't even have any books to sell. I'm not selling books, right? But there is a version of it at the end of my book. But it's Ignatius Press, and it's everywhere. I mean, it's in every Catholic bookstore. It's on Amazon.com. It's even in Barnes & Noble and Borders and bookstores like that. So it's Ignatius Press is, you know, well-distributed, tends to be everywhere.
What's the title?
The title is Salvation is from the Jews. And so anyway, so I'll kind of fast forward to the theme of the book because I only have another 10 minutes. For 10 years after my conversion, after my baptism, I was in agony. I felt I had a vocation. I felt this wasn't happening to me for no reason. I explored a number of religious forms of religious life, ranging from Carthusian monastery to diocesan priesthood. But every time I came close, I was given the grace of discernment that wasn't for me. And so I was in agony about what am I supposed to be doing? You know, what's the purpose of this? What's my vocation? And then about 10 years later, I was kind of feel like I was given this book to write. I mean, it just came pouring in. And I wrote it expecting it never to leave my word processor. I mean, I that's all I did. I just sat down and typed it and figured it would just stay on my computer for the rest of my life. And I printed it out and I put it in an envelope and I sent it to Ignatius Press just like that through the mail. And much to my amazement, they published it, which in itself is actually not all that small a miracle for, you know, a major publisher to just take a manuscript like that. So anyway, so let me start the substantive part of this with a quote about that ties together the book and my conversion story. It's from the Lehman Brothers, who were these great Jewish converts to the Catholic Church from the middle of the 19th century. You have heard it said, they were twin Jewish orphan brothers who converted together. They became priests, they became canons of the church. They were very active at the First Vatican Council. They were close friends of Pius IX. I'd like to close with a quote of theirs, too, if I have the time. You have heard it said that an honorable man should not change his religion, but this maxim is as false as it is cruel, and with respect to a Jew who wishes to become Catholic, doubly false. It is false the first time because for him as for all who stray and then return, there is honor rather than dishonor in abandoning error to return to the truth. It is false a second time, shamefully false, because a Jew in becoming Catholic does not change his religion but fulfills his religion, completes it, crowns it. The religion was initially patriarchal, that is, identified with the family of the patriarchs, then enlarged into a chosen people, and finally, in being universalized, it became something even more beautiful, the kingdom of God, the Catholic Church, which is for all people. Now, what's this say? It says that when a Jew becomes Catholic, he's not changing his religion, right? It's essentially the religion which changed. If the Catholic faith is true, then the Catholic Church is post-Messianic Judaism. It's the continuation of Judaism after the Jewish Messiah came. And Judaism was the embryonic form of the Catholic Church, so to speak, to prepare the way for the incarnation of Christ. Obviously, if the second person of the Most Holy Trinity were going to incarnate as a man, he would be incarnating at a particular point in time among a particular people, and that people would have to be prepared. And that's the story of the Old Testament. That's what the Jews were. They were chosen, you could say, kind of at random, or you could say because of the virtue of Abraham. Or you could say because they were the weakest and most miserable of all people, and God likes to choose the weakest and most miserable, so it's obvious that it's him at work. But in any case, they were chosen not because of their own merits, because somebody had to be chosen, and well-prepared, well-groomed to pave the way for the incarnation of God as man. They would have to be taught enough theology to know about the one true God and to worship him, to know about the fall of man, to know about the seriousness of sin, the need of redemption, the coming of the Messiah, and they would have to have received enough divine revelation to be able to identify the Messiah when he came, and to be the base from which that gospel could be propagated to the four corners of the earth. And in this they succeeded. And I know that there's this superficial way in which one can say that the Jews failed because they failed to recognize him, but they couldn't have failed in their basic chosen task, because their basic chosen task was to bring about the incarnation of Christ, and they did, and to spread the gospel to the four corners of the earth, and it has been spread to the four corners of the earth. So fundamentally, they must have succeeded. There's the mystery of their failure to recognize him when he came, and this is a really superficial run-through. It's not even a superficial run-through. What it is it's picking two or three points at random from about, not really at random, but two or three major points, you know, from far more in the book, not selling the book.
How much is it?
How much is it? I don't make anything from it. Honest. I know that you people are saying that, but I do this just for you.
If you sell that, you can make a trip off.
How much for five?
Ignatius sells it. It retails for $18. That's Ignatius's list price. Amazon has it for about $11. Overstock.com sometimes has it for about a buck less. I don't have any in self. I can't autograph them. I may need it still tomorrow night, and if I don't, it's earmarked. So that's what the Jews were chosen for the incarnation of Christ. But there's a further mystery, which is, what about their failure to recognize him, and what about their continued existence? Because I would argue that the mere fact that they still exist 2,000 years later, if you read the Old Testament, it's full of the Hittites and the Amorites and the Jebusites and the Edomites, which were tribes much more powerful and significant than the Jews, but you don't read about them anymore in the New York Times. There's a mystery to the Jews having persevered, and there's a mystery to their continual persecution, most notably in the Holocaust. Now, I don't have time to go into this, but it's all in the book.
Very good.
But the Holocaust is clearly diabolical. The chief exorcist of Rome said that Hitler was, without a doubt, personally consecrated to Satan. He got his start in an occult society, the Thule Society. It was the working class branch of the Thule Society which became the Nazi party. The Thule was like Atlantis. It was this mythical land in the Atlantic that sank. The people there had these superpowers. When Thule sank, the people, the supermen fled to Europe and Asia, intermarried, intermingled with the lower races, lost their superpowers. If the purity of the bloodlines could be reestablished, they would regain their superpowers. And that's a basic Superman myth. And it's from this Thule society, which was Hitler's first base. Now, if you look at what flowed into the Holocaust, it was clearly diabolical. It was occultism, which is diabolical. It was sexual depravity, and I won't go into that, but sexual depravity was absolutely fundamental to the rise of the Nazis and to Hitler himself personally. And eugenics, which you still see today in Planned Parenthood. There was a lot of interplay between... Hitler set up a committee for research on eugenics and a eugenics institute. And the head of the eugenics institute, Kaiser Wilhelm Eugenics Institute in, I think it was Berlin, which was Hitler's eugenics institute, which planned all the euthanasia programs and so forth, was Dr. Ernst Rudin, who was a frequent contributor to Margaret Sanger's Birth Control Review. And a board member of Margaret Sanger's, Lothar Stoddard, wrote a book called The Rising Tide of Color Against White Supremacy, which was the Bible, so to speak, in the Nazi school system to teach them about the need for exterminating the lower races or controlling their reproduction. So this stuff came straight from hell. Why should the devil be so interested in exterminating Jewish people? I would argue that because he knows that, according to prophecy, the second coming will be preceded by a wide-scale conversion of the Jews. And so if there were no Jews around, the prophecy couldn't be fulfilled. And if the Jews didn't convert, the prophecy couldn't be fulfilled. Now, he didn't succeed in exterminating Jews, but he did a good job of almost succeeding, but in slowing down the conversion of the Jews. The Holocaust had a tremendously negative effect on the conversion of the Jews. I think all of us Jewish converts here are, you know, have gotten it a lot. Like, how can you after the Holocaust? Whenever there's any danger of anything coming from the Catholic Church that looks like a mission to the Jews, they get thrown in their face, how can you after the Holocaust? Haven't you done enough? As though exterminating the Jews is sort of like morally equivalent to bringing them to their own Messiah. I mean, it's, you know, that in itself is diabolical distortion. And so I would argue that the current reluctance to evangelize the Jews is in some sense a partial success of this plot of the Holocaust. The mystery of the Jews' refusal to accept Christ and the role of the Jews or the association between the conversion of the Jews and the Second Coming is best brought out by St. Paul in his letter to the Romans, particularly chapter 11. So I will close with a very quick run-through of a couple of points from chapter 11 of Romans, which I hope sort of ties this together. So this is St. Paul writing. I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Okay, so we know from Scripture that the election of the Jews has not been terminated, has not been stopped. What then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Okay, so the Jews' failure to accept Christ was not entirely due to their own lack of virtue and their own stubbornness and hard-heartedness. Part of it was a mystery of divine providence, because as Paul says, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. And then Paul goes on to explain why God did this or why God might have done this. So I ask, have they stumbled so as to fall? By no means, but through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. Okay? So Paul is suggesting that it was through the failure of the Jews to accept Christ that salvation was able to come to the Gentiles. And this is kind of logical. I mean, if the Jews had all accepted Christ, then Christianity would have looked like Judaism, like a sect of Judaism. And it would have been much harder for it to spread to the Gentiles. And looking at it from the Jewish perspective, it would have been hard for the Jewish Christians not to feel like it was part of Judaism and that they owned it and that Gentile Christians were actually second-class Christians. Paul continues. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? For if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? Okay, so there are some special power that's going to enter the church when the Jews come in. Paul continues. If the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in their place to share the richness of the olive tree, do not boast over the branches. If you do boast, remember it is not you that support the root, but the root that supports you. You will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. And even the others, if they do not persist in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you have been cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these natural branches be grafted back into their own olive tree? Okay, so St. Paul is presenting this image as though that organically the church is like this olive tree, and in the beginning the branches were the Jews, and then those branches were cut off so the Gentiles could be grafted in, which are the branches from the wild olive tree. But when those cut off branches are grafted back in to the trunk and the root, which was originally their nature, I'm not saying this, Paul says it, you know, how much more will these natural branches be grafted back into the olive tree, that there will be a particularly natural resonance there. Paul ties up, lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. So again, this hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. So let me just say two things about this, number of the Gentiles coming in. One is something that Jesus said, and I think it is Luke, but I will find it. Yeah, Luke 21. This is Jesus speaking right before the crucifixion, or shortly before the crucifixion. So Luke 21. The Jews will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations, in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Okay? So Jesus is saying that Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jerusalem was trodden down by the Gentiles from 135 AD when the Romans suppressed the last Jewish revolt and the Jews were banned from Jerusalem under pain of death until 1967 AD, right, when the Temple Mount came back into the hands of the Jews. You could consider that entire period Jerusalem being trodden down by the feet of the Gentiles. And then what does Jesus say after that? Then the times of the Gentiles will have been fulfilled. We know from Romans that that will then be closely followed by the entry of the Jews into the church. And then Jesus goes into a description of the second coming. And just for fun, I will point out that the image that Jesus uses is there'll be distress of nations and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves. And that's been more in the news in the last year than I remember. So, and we know this connection between the conversion of the Jews and the second coming also from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Paragraph 674 says, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." Okay, so it's kind of nailed pretty shut with that. So I'm going to close there, but I'm going to close with that quote of the Lehman Brothers. But so that's what this is about, that's what I'm about, which is there's not much I can do for the conversion of the Jews directly except pray and encourage others to pray, especially Catholics who have kind of had it beaten out of them that maybe they're not even supposed to be praying for the conversion of the Jews. I know there was no way to be happy in my Jewish nature until I came into the church. I am sure that the other Jews here will say the same thing. And if people think that's unique to us, that Jews somehow can be happy without Christ, I suggest they go and see a Woody Allen movie. So, if you need more evidence. The quote that I want to close in is from, because it's a prayer, so I want to close with it as a prayer, inviting you to pray it if you feel so inclined. Now, This was a postulatum from the First Vatican Council. A postulatum is a petition. It was circulated by the Lehman Brothers. Remember those Jewish twin brothers? All of this is the book. And it was signed by virtually all of the Council Fathers, and heartily endorsed by Pius IX. And so here's the text of the postulatum, the petition from the First Vatican Council. And it's very different from what you hear coming today from some of our bishops. "The undersigned fathers of the council humbly yet urgently, beseechingly pray that the Holy Ecumenical Council of Vatican deign to come to the aid of the unfortunate nation of Israel with an entirely paternal invitation, that finally exhausted by a wait no less futile than long, the Israelites hasten to recognize the Messiah, our Savior Jesus Christ, truly promised to Abraham and announced by Moses, thus completing and crowning, not changing, the Mosaic religion. The undersigned fathers have the very firm confidence that the Holy Council will have compassion on the Israelites because they are always very dear to God on account of their fathers and because it is from them that the Christ was born according to the flesh. Would that they then speedily acclaim the Christ, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessed be he who comes in the name of the Lord. Would that they hurl themselves into the arms of the Immaculate Virgin Mary, even now their sister according to the flesh, who wishes likewise to be their mother according to grace, as she is ours." So that's it. Thanks. Thank you. Okay, is there an official? What should I do about time? Because I know how scrupulous we are about
one
time.
One more minute.
No, okay.
Two minutes. Jim?
You mentioned you thought the best thing that you could do is perhaps every Catholic
Oh, no, do it. Don't go out on street corners, wear sandwich boards. I'm serious. Evangelize. But in the end, prayer is behind everything. And I basically say that because most people don't have it in them to evangelize, except as the occasion arises, but they do have it in them to pray. But I will say something about evangelization, because I think that if you pray for the conversion of the Jews, and if you have Jews in your life, then God quite often will give you opportunities to evangelize. And the key is to recognize those opportunities and not to be scared by that voice saying, but what if they take offense? Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I'm treading on sacred ground. Because that's, I think, coming from the other one. I got an email, for instance, from a Catholic woman who said that her neighbor, who was Jewish, wanted to see the Passion of the Christ and asked this Catholic woman to go with her so that she could explain it. And this Catholic woman emailed me saying, am I allowed to do that? You know? So, I mean, it's that kind of thing. There's a tendency to back off. So, by all means, if the Holy Spirit opens a door, jump through it with both feet. And if they don't open a door, I think what you should do is make the Jews jealous to whatever extent you can. In other words, let them know, if you have Jewish friends, what your relationship to God is, what the sacraments mean to you, the consolation you get from prayer, the consolation you get from the sacraments, and just that tangible presence of God in your life, because I know, again, from my pre-conversion experience, that's like an itch that doesn't go away. Then you kind of like, hey, there's something going on here, and it kind of makes you hungry for that. So, and that's also completely inoffensive, right, because you're not even addressing conversion itself. You're just letting them know how rich your pipeline to God is. Yeah?
I've noticed that in the Christian organizations, we are Christian Catholics, and the Protestants, they look at us like we're not part of them. And they try to go into our group and evangelize us, become Christians like they are. Now, does this thing philosophy or mentality grip the Jewish people when you say, I bring someone into the church from the Jewish faith, are they scandalized? Are they looked down as lesser Jews? What happens then?
Yeah, if a Jew comes into the Catholic Church, he is looked down on as a lesser Jew, I think. I mean, it's not popular. As a matter of fact, it's not even, it's the image often is that you've gone over to the enemy. There's a sense, and this also comes to a larger sense in the Holocaust. But, and I'll close with this answer to this question, because it's a good question. One thing that is useful for Catholics to keep in mind is that Christianity is a religion of faith, and you become Christian through faith and through the sacraments. But if in the absence of the sacraments, even through faith, as in the baptism by desire. And the Jewish religion is a religion is an ethnos. It's a religion of a people. It's a religion by the bloodline. And this makes sense because the Jews were chosen to prepare the way for the Messiah, and in order to do that, they had to stay separate from everyone else for 2,000 years. They had to not intermarry. They had to rigidly protect their religion against assimilation, or else they wouldn't be there for the coming of the Messiah. So my theory is that God gave them this tremendous insularity, this divine imperative, that the most important thing in the world is for your children to grow up Jewish, even if you don't believe in God, okay, which I think is almost universal among Jews. And I don't think that's just like a weird, stubborn artifact. I think God put that there because from God's perspective, before the coming of the Messiah, it was true. The most important thing was for the Jewish people to preserve themselves as a people. So I think that's still there, and that's a huge bar to conversion, and that's one reason why if a Jew becomes Christian, it's viewed as an unforgivable defection. But I could go on forever, but it's, that's not what I'm here for. Thank you.